I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're in the middle of the August break. Lawmakers meeting constituents, rallying for November elections. How's it going? Well, a planned Islamic center in New York has taken center stage from Arizona to the White House. Will it become this summer's equivalent of last summer's town hall meetings? Rick Klein is Washington editor for ABC World News and co-host of the ABC News Washington Post political webcast Top Line. And Rick, this building has come to be called the Ground Zero Mosque. It is neither. It's not at Ground Zero. It's a full two city blocks away. It's not a mosque. It's a community center with a prayer area inside it. But that's not the perception. And when the president was asked about it on Friday, he did not address the misperceptions, did he?
No, and in some ways he may have fed into them. By talking about this in terms of religious liberty, he made people feel like this was a mosque and that the location of it was important. And those are, of course, critical details. We're not talking about a site that was affected by the 9/11 attacks. It's a couple of blocks away. Also in the area are all manner of adult bookstores and racy locations, an off-track betting parlor, bars and restaurants, and everything that goes on in two dense blocks of lower Manhattan. And as you say, it's not just a place of religious worship. It is a large cultural center that that the Islamic community in New York has been looking for some time.
Well, what the president said was Muslims have the same right to practice their religion as anyone else, including the right to build a place of worship and a community center on private property. He then came back and said it's not that he was condoning this particular building, but the right to build. Former Republican House Majority Leader Newt Gingrich, however, yesterday compared the building to Nazis being allowed to put up a sign next to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. How much do you think this is going to become the topic of August?
Yeah, President Obama really nationalized what had been a local issue. His White House had not commented on it. By him elevating it, he has now put every Democrat in the nation in the position of potentially being asked about it. And we saw the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, say yesterday that he respects First Amendment rights, but he also thinks this mosque should be put elsewhere. So essentially, he broke with the president in terms of at least the emphasis of his statement. And that is going to give cover to a lot of Democrats that may give similar statements to say we respect liberties, but we would like this to be voluntarily located elsewhere. And it's also going to give a lot of openings to Republicans to make this an issue.
Well, some would say the president had no other choice but to say that Americans have the right to practice a freedom of religion. And some of his opponents now were supporters of this building. They include conservative talk show host Laura Ingraham. In December of 2009, she interviewed Daisy Khan, the wife of the Muslim imam behind this New York project. And Ingraham liked the idea. Here is how she started the interview.
Let's talk about the Islamic Center at Ground Zero. Questions, I can't find many people who really have a problem with it. Bloomberg is for it. You got rabbis in New York saying they don't have a problem with it.
That's Mayor Bloomberg. She's speaking of the mayor of New York. And here's how she ended that interview.
I like what you're trying to do, and Ms. Khan, we appreciate it. And come on my radio show sometime.
So there's Laura Ingraham, who now, actually yesterday, I believe, said on Good Morning America that the building of this community center means that the terrorists have won. Do Republicans smell blood here, Rick Klein? Is this perhaps the town hall meeting? You know, your grandma is going to get killed by the new health care plan of this summer.
It certainly is for this week. Now, we'll see how long it lasts. It's hard to see where the oxygen comes from in the long term, and the Republicans, frankly, have to be careful about how far they push this because you don't want to be seen as opposing religious freedoms. But it is definitely an uncomfortable thing, and while President Obama may have felt that he was forced into this, a lot of Democrats feel like he could have easily stayed silent on this or at least just spoken in the broad terms and not come out as strongly as he did in that initial statement he gave Friday, really seeming to endorse the whole idea of building the center.
Well, and also, again, adding to the misperceptions about it, it is not at Ground Zero and it's not a mosque. But Democrats also have their own charge against Republicans. They say outrage over this center comes just weeks after many House Republicans opposed a new medical program to monitor and treat emergency workers and others suffering effects from exposure to hazardous materials at Ground Zero.
That's right, and Democrats are trying to turn it around a little bit and say, look, if you really cared about the 9/11 victims, you'd work on that bill. That, though, I don't think has the same resonance as this issue. This is hallowed ground. I think everyone in this country would agree. Anything in the vicinity of Ground Zero has a special ring to it in people's minds and imaginations and memories. And so I think this has the potential just to continue to be a potent issue that could play out in lots of places far from lower Manhattan.
Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News, co-host of the ABC News Washington Post political webcast Top Line. Rick, thanks as always.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
question. Is everyone who goes to war a hero?
I'm looking for a great warrior.
Great warrior? Wars not make one great.
Wars not make one great. A scene from the Star Wars film, The Empire Strikes Back. Yoda, the wizened Jedi master, cautioning the young Luke Skywalker with a message that our next guest, William Astori, first heard as a young man starting his career in the military. And it's one that resonates with him today in his belief that simply joining the armed services doesn't make one great. Serving in combat doesn't either. William Astori is a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. He teaches history at the Pennsylvania College of Technology. His essay appeared in the Los Angeles Times. You can read it at hereandnow.org. And he joins us from WVYA in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And this thinking is sacrilege, you know, to some.
Well, it is to some, you're right. And some people are offended by it because they like to think of the service member, their loved one or a relative, as a personal hero. The point of my piece was that we need to be careful not to dilute the meaning of the term hero. You know, we need to be careful not to apply it in a blanket sense. We also need to be careful not to associate the term hero too closely or too exclusively with the military. To me, the person who is performed in a heroic way in my life was my mother, who endured a very painful and ultimately fatal bout of cancer while raising five children in a very difficult time during the 1970s. But we in the United States often associate hero and heroism far too closely with, you know, men of action, occasionally with women of action, but it seems like we use it far too often and connect it with service in the military or perhaps police officers or firefighters.
And I should say that you come from a family of firefighters, and yet, as you're saying, in that family, it was your mom who stoically endured this illness who was the hero to you and not the man of action, the firefighter. But tell us more about how this applies for you to the military because, you know, as you say, you get asked, why isn't someone who volunteers to serve, not knowing what their fate will be, heroic? Let's put a finer point on it. Why wasn't my dad, who enlisted at 16 and saw hand-to-hand combat at Guadalcanal, heroic? Why wasn't your uncle, who earned a Bronze Star at Guadalcanal, a hero?
I don't like to challenge people if they have a father or an uncle who served at combat in the front line, if they've been decorated for valor in combat. Chances are that person very well could be a hero or could have served heroically in combat. But I think that even within the military, you know, my service for 20 years in the military, you know, I think I served honorably, but I would not characterize myself as a hero because of my 20 years of service. And I actually think there are some dangers when we apply the hero label far too generously.
Let's get to that. What is the danger of broad brushing people who go to war? You write about seeing, you know, a sign about our American heroes at your local post office, which sort of has helped spark this. What's wrong with that sort of broad brush?
I think that, you know, the rhetoric of heroism, the idea that simply joining the military and donning that uniform somehow makes you a hometown hero, ennobles, you know, military service and service during wartime, that I think has some dangerous implications. General Sherman during the Civil War famously said that war is cruelty and you cannot refine it. And he also said, of course, war is all hell. When we heroize war, when we think of military members as heroes, we tend to obscure the brutality of war, and we also have difficulty coming to terms with, you know, the blunders that our troops commit.
Right, because if we've assigned them all as heroes, well, then how can a hero do something destructive or, as you say, sometimes atrocious behavior? That doesn't compute for us. So what, we don't acknowledge the atrocious behavior if we've already assigned someone the title of hero?
I think it becomes difficult to visualize our troops, most of whom try very hard not to commit blunders. But, you know, those inevitably happen in combat. But if we heroize the troops, if we see them only in heroic terms, then there's a tendency for us, you know, not to want to acknowledge the fact that our troops are only human. They're not always going to get it right.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're going to be afraid. Sometimes they're going to panic. And heroes aren't supposed to do that. As an aside, the fact that we think of our troops as heroes often makes it more difficult for them when they come home because, you know, they want to talk about the difficult experiences that they've been under. They want to talk about the fact that they were afraid. They may even want to seek help because they're suffering from post-traumatic stress. But the narrative is, well, you're a hero. You know, you're supposed to be tough. You shouldn't have done anything wrong because you're a hero. So all of this hero rhetoric, which we tend to use because we think that's going to help the troops, actually might dissuade them from seeking the help that they need.
Or, as we know from all the reporting the last few years, make the military blind to the problems because, again, we heard about, you know, military leaders telling people to buck up as opposed to acknowledging their issues. So this idea of labeling everyone a hero produces this, as you call it, cognitive dissonance in the minds of Americans who can't imagine heroes either killing innocents or having problems. But you also say that seeing the military as universally heroic can serve to prolong wars. Give your example.
The example I used was in World War One. World War One was a horrendous war. You know, 9 million soldiers died on all sides of the conflict. And the war dragged on for more than 4 years. And in Germany, they used the modifier Helden, or hero, And that modifier was used for everything. You know, even when troops died, they went to a hero's death. They were buried in a hero's grave.
Heldenblut?
Exactly. They shed hero's blood when they were shot. So as a result, it made it very difficult to negotiate because, you know, after Germany had suffered more than 1 million heroes killed, well, how do you negotiate with an enemy? When you've elevated your troops to hero status and you've vilified the enemy, as, of course, anti-heroes. And we have a tendency to do that, of course, ourselves in this country. We see our troops almost universally as heroes, and we see them as fighting barbaric terrorists. And when you define the enemy as, you know, a barbaric terrorist, as you define them as inhuman, it makes it very difficult to negotiate any kind of settlement. And as a result, wars tend to drag on.
This reminds me that when I looked up hero in my dictionary, the second definition was a person noted for courage or nobility of purpose, especially one who's risked or sacrificed his or her life. And you agree that in individual cases that would apply. But the first definition of hero, this is in the American Heritage Dictionary, is one who is favored by the gods. And I'm wondering, it sounds like that this is the danger that you're describing, that you worry about, that once you set up someone for being a god, there's nowhere to go but for them to fall because they aren't gods.
Yes, that's exactly right.
That's retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Bill Astori, who says not all who serve should be called heroes. And we just got this email from Specialist J.J. Carney, who writes, "Thanks for this. I'm a 100% disabled Vietnam veteran. I served 3 years of active duty. I enlisted out of high school at the age of 19. I did my job to the best of my ability and received my honorable discharge and an Army combination. I am not, and most veterans are not, heroes. Heroes are people that go way beyond just their abilities and at risk to themselves do something average people like me couldn't do." Well, he still sounds like a hero, I'm sure, to many of you. When we come back, more reaction from veterans here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Bill Astori, a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who says using the word hero to describe all members of the military is not only inaccurate, it can be dangerous. There's a link to his Los Angeles Times op-ed at herenow.org. But, Bill, you've had a lot of comments to your essay, some, you know, we would predict. Dorian DeWind, who's also a retired Air Force officer, says, "You know, when I refer to U.S. service members as heroes, I do it out of general, across-the-board respect and admiration for them." And he continues, "I know everyone's not really a hero, but why nitpick? Why be stingy when it comes to praising the military?" Now, Bill, you've said one of the reasons you think this is dangerous is that Americans won't be able to see atrocities, for instance, if they've labeled everyone a hero. Dorian DeWind disagrees that that will happen. So your thoughts?
I think to a certain extent, Americans in general are somewhat guilty about the wars that we're engaged in right now. After all, you know, our population is well over 300 million, and yet the percentage of Americans who actually serve in the military and place themselves in danger is fairly small. And nowadays, we like to think of those troops as all volunteers, although a lot of working-class people are joining the military, really because they can't find a job in the very difficult economy we have now. So I think that one of the reasons why people want to apply the hero label in a blanket sense is because of a sense of obligation, perhaps even guilt, that we're asking such a small percentage of our population, mostly blue-collar, working-class, lower-middle-class, to fight seemingly endless wars. We continue to ask our troops to serve 3, 4, and 5 tours. They're coming back with damaged minds and bodies. They're coming back to broken families. And so I think many of us see is the least we can do for them is to call them heroes. And so I kind of understand that, but I still, you know, I maintain my position that the hero label, when it's applied in a blanket sense, actually has some dangers that I've already talked about.
Yeah. Well, and you've had a lot of supporters in that thinking. Patrick O'Brien is a former college professor who writes, he's always cautioned that the word hero has been used so frequently to characterize not just the military, but police, firefighters, and anyone else, that it's been detrimental to its own definition. He says this usage distorts reality. But he also adds praise to those who have done heroic acts and often say, I'm no hero, because they usually are. And Gregory Marcella, who is a Vietnam vet, agrees with you that maybe Americans, with all the bad news about the wars and the flailing economy, need to see something positive. But he believes that servicemen probably cringe when they are called heroes because, like him, a Vietnam vet, they know the consequences of armed combat and they don't want to glorify it. Bill, just, you know, what are you hearing from servicemen and women?
A lot of the letters that I received from service members were like the last letter that you cited. You know, I've heard from quite a few service members, you know, combat veterans from Vietnam or from Desert Storm, and they agree. You know, they recognize that the face of war is a brutal one. And when we talk about heroes, when we talk about war as being, you know, sort of uniquely efficacious in producing heroes, that's a disturbing idea. I guess I'd like to go back to this notion that the term hero should not be used or assigned so prominently, almost exclusively, to a military setting. I think we need to look for heroes in all realms of our life. It may even be the case, for example, that although our society tends not to think this way, what about the person who goes to an American Air Force base and protests nuclear missiles or nuclear bombers, and the person is brave enough to engage in an act of civil disobedience and protest, and, you know, they end up getting arrested for that. They end up getting a record for that, and they're sacrificing. Is that behavior heroic? You know, I think most people would say no, you know, that of course not. You know, they're protesters, they're behaving in an inappropriate way, and they don't deserve our respect.
I'm going to underscore that. I'm sure there are listeners right now who are saying, this was an Air Force lieutenant colonel. I mean, you've gone off the reservation, you know, by equating a protester who doesn't, you know, risk their life at all with you know, putting them maybe ahead and saying they're heroic when you're saying servicemen and women aren't necessarily.
I guess what I'm trying to come back to is this notion that there are many ways to be a good citizen. And certainly one way to be a good citizen of the United States is to volunteer and serve in the military. And, you know, there's a lot of sacrifice involved in that service, obviously. But another way of being a good citizen is exercising your freedom of speech. One of the things that most service members, if you talk to them, will respect is they respect the fact that people who are willing to speak up for something that they believe in. And if you have an anti-war protester or someone who's anti-military or believes that we are simply spending too much on some aspect of the military, or they believe that the fact that our nation's nuclear policy is still too bellicose, too dangerous, and that person is willing to sacrifice, that person's willing to protest, I don't think that behavior is necessarily heroic, but I think that behavior is deserving of respect as well, because that citizen is exercising his or her rights and is trying to do a service to society, just as the service member who signs up. I wouldn't equate the two, but I think both are deserving of respect.
In other words, you're saying sort of reframe the word hero. That's William Astori, again, a history teacher at Pennsylvania College of Technology and also a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel. We'll link you to his op-ed on the overuse of the term hero at hereandnow.org. Bill, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Robin.
And by the way, while at hereandnow.org, we'd love to hear from you, especially if you're a veteran or active military. Again, just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, or you can scroll down and click on Leave a Comment and do just that. And don't forget, also while there, you can download a podcast, take us with you wherever you go, hereandnow.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Arizona's new illegal immigration law has been bad for tourism, but it may be a boon for another part of the state's economy, the private companies that run five of the state's prisons. Also, what's showing at the White House movie theater these days. And still to come today, Travie McCoy, he of the billionaire hit, has he met Oprah and the Queen? The latest news is next, Here and Now. Kosovo, which has declared itself an independent state, is still struggling to find its identity, 11 years after the war that forced Serbia to relinquish control. Last month, Kosovo got a boost when the International Court of Justice ruled that its breakaway from Serbia was legal. But Kosovo still faces huge problems, including lingering ethnic divisions with Serbians, corruption, and a heavy reliance on international assistance. The BBC's Balkan correspondent Mark Lowen reports.
Troops from the recently formed Kosovo Security Force prepare for their regular exercise in southern Kosovo. A lightly armed civil protection unit, they're learning how to defuse explosives. The training comes from some of the 10,000 NATO peacekeepers that remain since the end of the Kosovan War 11 years ago. With the equipment in place, the detonation order is given. And with that, the exercise is complete. It's all part of Kosovo's transition, moving from an international protectorate towards the goal of a self-sufficient state. But 2 hours' drive away, you come here to northern Mitrovica, where the Kosovo Security Force and other Kosovan government institutions are rejected. People here don't accept the unilateral declaration of independence from Serbia in 2008 by Kosovo's Albanian majority, and the Serbian flag flutters above the buildings in front of me. The Kosovan government still doesn't control the north. For now, people here feel isolated and powerless.
I lived in Serbia until now, and I can't say I'm living in a different state. The situation is bad for us. There is no security.
I think the north will never be part of the independent Republic of Kosovo, just like the rest of Kosovo will no longer be part of Serbia.
Mitrovica saw some of the worst rioting after Kosovo secession, when Serbs who had occupied the court building clashed with NATO.
My friends, brothers.
Today, calm has largely returned to this area. Children play in the main square by the fountain, but crime has flourished from the political deadlock. The European Union has started to increase its presence in the north, including through its rule of law mission in Kosovo, ULEX, whose deputy head is Roy Reeve.
This is, has been, not just in the last 2 years, but before that, largely a black hole. There has been no effective policing of the criminal elements here in the north during the last 10 years or so. We need to break that mould, we intend to break that mould, and we will be starting to do that within the coming weeks.
But ULEX has other problems to deal with too, including corruption, widely believed to be endemic and arguably the biggest hindrance to a functional government. In a recent raid, the central bank governor was arrested, led from his office to the waiting cars under the gaze of the local press. But when ULEX began to investigate the Minister of Transport, an old ally of the Prime Minister, Hashim Thaçi, the government reacted badly. So, I asked the Prime Minister, is he protecting former colleagues rather than tackling the problem?
I will not protect anyone. The law will be without compromise for anybody who violates it. The past gives immunity to nobody.
The International Crisis Group says that, according to their research, virtually no one they speak to on the ground believes that the current government of Kosovo supports the rule of law.
This is the first government that has started fighting corruption. For 10 years, our eyes have been closed to this phenomenon. We will have zero tolerance in this fight.
This report is assessing
the weaknesses and coordination of Kosovo's police.
But critics say the government itself is at the heart of Kosovo's stagnation. Ilir Deda is director of the political think tank Kipred.
The entire corruptive activities happen within our government. So there is no political will to fight corruption because it means that the political establishment would have to start fighting itself.
In a modern office in the capital, Pristina, Kosovan passports are being made. The gold stamp of the Republic of Kosovo proudly set against a dark blue cover. Kosovo has its machinery of government in place, and some of it functions well. But the problems run deep, and still most countries haven't recognised its independence. Kosovo is moving forward slowly, but the challenge now is to build the state.
That report from the BBC's Balkans correspondent Mark Lowen. Coming up, your letters and some of the songs of summer. That's in 30 seconds here and now. And let's start with some of your thoughts. We heard from so many of you after our conversations this week about drowning. We spoke with a mother closing down a pool rather than be responsible for all the neighborhood kids. And we spoke with Francesco Pia, a former lifeguard who in the 50s and 60s changed the thinking about drowning. It's not like it's portrayed on Baywatch with victims dramatically yelling for help. It's quiet and quick. It takes just 20 seconds for children to succumb. Many were amazed to hear this, and by the way, we'll link you to Pia's work at our website, herenow.org. But many of you weren't surprised. Kate Redling of Oak Park, Illinois, writes, "I've rescued my own son twice. Even knowing what to look for and with many years' experience as a certified lifeguard, I could easily have missed him slipping underwater at age 2 in a kiddie pool where he lost his footing, and once this summer at age 5 when he stepped off the ledge in a backyard pool. I can still see his little 2-year-old eyes looking up at me through the water as he tried to stand in shallow water. All water must be respected." Well, many of you shared stories like that, but Bambi Nicklin had a different take. She writes, "Your backyard pool safety story was fear-mongering. Not once did you mention teaching children to swim. Have a pool party for all the kids in the neighborhood and teach them to swim. Just use common sense." Well, we also learned recently about a project to bring women from Afghanistan to be educated at Wellesley College. We'll link you to that as well. But meantime, we stand corrected. We said Wellesley was an Ivy League school. It's not. And Paige Daniel and many others reminded us it's one of the 7 sister schools with an historic role in educating women in an academic world that discriminated against women. Well, finally, we reported on how Harley Davidson has threatened to leave Milwaukee because of a labor dispute. We mentioned that the Fonz from Happy Days lived in Milwaukee and rode a Harley. Well, we heard from Harley fans, including Bill Kachia in Ashland, Oregon. He writes, "The Fonz may have started on a Harley knucklehead, but it was too big for him, and so a 500cc 1950 Triumph Trophy was substituted." Well, we decided to go right to the source, Henry Winkler.
In the beginning, the very first bike that I rode as the Fonz, it was a Harley Davidson. It was called a Hog, I believe was the technical term for that bike. But it was so big for me that I requested something more manageable. And the second bike I rode was the same Triumph Steve McQueen used to jump the fence in The Great Escape.
Wow. So all our listeners are right.
Well, NPR listeners usually are right.
Do I understand that the first time you tried to ride the bike, you crashed it?
Yes, I did. I crashed the bike into the sound truck. I wound up under the sound truck, nearly killing the director of photography. They rushed over and they grabbed the bike because it was rented. And then they remembered I, too, was under that truck.
And this program note, Henry Winkler, the Fonz, will be back on Here and Now Thursday talking about his current television projects, Royal Pains and Children's Hospital. And we'd always love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there. That's hereandnow.org. We've been sharing music this summer. At our website, hereandnow.org, you can see some very sophisticated listener listening choices. And then there's me. I'm loving the pop hits this summer. Don't call my name.
can't tell you what it really is. I can only tell you what it feels like. And right now it's a steel knife in my windpipe.
Into the night.
In that airplane from the night sky, like shooting stars. I can really use a wish right now. Wish right now. Wish right now.
We started with Usher, Lady Gaga, Eminem, and Airplanes from B.O.B. with Hayley Williams. Love that one. And then every three or four songs this summer, what up, Oprah?
I wanna be a billionaire so freaking bad. Buy all of the things I never had. I wanna be on the cover of Forbes magazine. Smiling next to Oprah and the Queen.
That's Billionaire by Travie McCoy with Bruno Mars. It's the clean version, the one my 10-year-old nephew Josh, what up Josh, can't stop singing. It's off Travie McCoy's first solo album, Lazarus. He's also the lead singer of the band Gym Class Heroes. And Travie McCoy joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome and congratulations on what we've decided is the song of the summer.
Thank you so much, and thank you for dubbing it the song of the summer.
Well, it just, I mean, it's everywhere. And we understand Bruno Mars brought you the hook, you know, I want to be a billionaire. And you didn't like it at first?
Melodically, I thought it was awesome. But with the way things are right now, you know, recession and people like struggling to get jobs or struggling to keep the jobs they have. When I first heard it, it was just like, I can't really come out the gate, you know, talking about just wanting to have money. But I sat on it because I felt like there was something really, really special about it. You know, it's really breezy with a reggae vibe. And so I went home and I listened to it over and over again. And I had one of those eureka moments and I was like, all right, you know what? I can take this and flip it and pose the question to the listener. If you were a billionaire, would you be selfish or would you be selfless? You know, and it's just me talking about what I'd do if I had the money, you know.
Yeah, I would have a show like Oprah. I would be the host of Everyday Christmas. Give Travie a wish list. I'd probably pull an Angelina and Brad Pitt and adopt a bunch of babies that ain't never had shit. Give away a few Mercedes like, here, lady, have this. And last but not least, grant somebody their last wish. It's been a couple months that I've been single, so you can call me Travie Claus, minus the ho-ho.
By the way, you know we love it. You know that, I've told you. We love the new CD, but this is Aunt Robin talking here. You use freaking on the radio version, another word entirely on the CD. Why did you do that?
Now, that was the thing that we struggled over because the original, there was no freaking in the original.
Okay.
It was straight to the F-bomb. But then we were like, wait a minute, we can't get radio play with this. And then, you know, we were thinking about reversing it and, you know, that always sounds really bad. And then taking it out and then... We're like, freaking is so cute, you know? Like, it's like...
It is.
And it gets the point across.
I wanna be a billionaire, so freaking bad.
So bad.
Buy all of the things I never had.
Welcome back. Here are some more monster hits from the summer. LaRue's Bulletproof, which my nephew thought was pudding proof. And, of course, Katy Perry's California Girls.
California girls were unforgettable. Daisy Duke's bikinis on top.
But today we're talking with Travie McCoy. His Billionaire is everywhere. Again, a warning to parents, this is the clean radio version, the version on the new CD, Lazarus. Not so clean.
I wanna be on the cover of Forbes magazine.
Speaking of the CD, the rest of it is soaring and uplifting. Let's listen to another cut. This is Dr. Feelgood with Gnarls Barkley's CeeLo Green. So, Travie, we understand you also weren't sure about that whole idea of an uplifting tone. You were in a dark place, you said?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't sure. It was that I wasn't in a very good headspace. I'd just kind of, you know, gotten out of a highly publicized breakup. And there's all these emotions that were kind of, like, falling into my notebook and onto records.
We weren't going to bring it up, but the breakup was with Katy Perry. But there was also something else we just want to ask you about, because you acknowledged on your blog that you'd been hiding a drug addiction. This is in early 2008.
Yeah. I've always worn my heart on my sleeve, and anyone who's followed Gym Class Heroes could probably call themselves a close friend to me, you know, because I'm so open in my lyrics. And I had 6 knee surgeries within 2 months, and I was introduced to a painkiller called OxyContin that I had no idea about. You know, I was taking it for the pain, and then there's really no instruction book to this type of lifestyle. The touring, the nonstop press, and it was so new to me, and I have really, really bad anxiety, and I could get away by taking pills, numbing myself from, you know, the scariness of fame.
Well, in your blog, you said you felt an enormous amount of guilt for glorifying drugs in your music, and you were talking about going to rehab, and you did, and you put that behind you. So you really are a Lazarus, I'm thinking, which, again, that's the name of your new CD.
Totally, totally. And today I'm in the best mental and, I think, physical health I've been in years, and I just wanted the record to reflect that, you know?
Well, it does. Let's listen to a little of the song, We'll Be All Right.
Tonight you won't be by yourself, so just leave your problems on the shelf, show. You won't want to be nowhere else, else. So let's go, we got the club light. And all the girls saying,
We'll Be All Right, from Travie McCoy on his new CD, Lazarus. But just to catch people up, you were born in Geneva, New York. Your dad, Haitian. Your mom, of Irish and Native American descent. And you started the group Gym Class Heroes with Matt McGinley because you were, what, heroes in gym class?
Not at all. We were actually anti. But I will tell you this. We excelled in ping pong. We were very, very, very good at ping pong.
Let's hear a little of your hit, Cupid's Chokehold.
Take a look at my girlfriend, she's the only one I got. And not much of a girlfriend, I never seem to get like.
It's been some time since we last spoke. This is gonna sound like a bad joke, but mama, I fell in love again. It's safe to say I have a new girlfriend.
Travie McCoy, what am I hearing there? Is that Supertramp? So, homage?
It's from a song called Breakfast in America, and it's one of those records that was always lying around the house as a kid, and I remember it because the cover had, like, this chubby waitress, but I remember my dad playing the record, and I'd always be like, Dad, put on the record with the fat lady, you know, and, like, and, you know, years later, it's funny, that was actually our first venture into using loops or samples, and ended up being one of our biggest hits.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking there's a song on your new album that also reflects some of your earlier influences as a kid, and it's called A Kid Again.
Yeah,
let's listen to a little of that.
And this was way before PlayStation. Rushing home to watch video vibrations. Man, I tell you, Sherry Carter could have got the business. And I can't forget Rachel from Caribbean Rhythms.
In a way, this song makes you sort of a voice of your generation. You're talking about a very specific time. I love that. Before PlayStation.
Yeah.
Are you aware that some of your listeners, and my nephew comes to mind, at 29, you are a wise elder to him?
Yeah. It's funny because when I talk to people older than me about music and, you know, the music that I'm influenced by, they look at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, and I've always been called an old soul because of the things that interest me and the things I'm into.
Like what?
Hall & Oates, for instance. Huge Hall & Oates fan. Probably the biggest Hall & Oates fan in the world.
Really?
Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions and Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. One of my favorite songs when I was a kid was Across 110th Street by Bobby Womack. And I used to run around singing, and kids are like, what are you singing? You know, like, that's not Michael Jackson, you know.
Across 110th Street.
Well, kids are singing your songs, and we actually decided to call one up. I think we have my nephew on the line.
Awesome.
Josh, you there?
Yeah.
What was your favorite song this summer in the car?
Billionaire.
Yeah. Can you sing it?
I want to be a billionaire so freaking bad. Buy all your dad things I never had. I want to be cover of Forbes magazine. Smiling next to Oprah and the Queen.
What up, Oprah? we've got Travie McCoy on the line. Is there anything you want to ask him?
How did you learn to sing that well?
Oh, thank you. Honestly, I've always been really, really insecure about my singing voice, and I've never taken a vocal lesson in my life. But I was fortunate enough to spend a little time with Daryl Hall when we worked on the last Gym Class Heroes record, and we shot something called Live from Daryl's Place, and he actually made me sing lead on all the songs that we performed. I was petrified out of my mind, but you know, I bit the bullet and just ran with it, and ever since then, I've been a little more confident.
Hey, Josh, so what do you take from that? Keep up your singing, okay, kid?
Yep.
Okay.
He's awesome.
He's awesome. Thanks, Josh. You are too. Bye.
Well, bye.
You know, Travie McCoy, first of all, wow, insecure about your voice because it's beautiful. But secondly, how does that feel? Every time you turn on the radio, you hear that voice now.
It's crazy. It really is, you know. The first time I heard Gym Class Heroes on the radio, there's just something, you know, the fact that we're hearing it, but whoever's tuned into the station is hearing it as well, you know. And it was just a special moment. And it's the same thing now. Whenever I hear it, I'm just like, I get those little tingle bunnies down my spine, you know.
That's Travie McCoy. His new CD is Lazarus. His current hit, Billionaire, you hear it everywhere. Travie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was an awesome interview.